From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've been raised to think of bacteria, microbes, as the other, foreign bodies, dangerous, germs, and some are. But it turns out, overall, microbes are us. Our bodies carry 10 times as many bacteria cells as human cells in our guts, on our skin, helping us do all kinds of essential things, our microbiome. Its health is our health, it turns out, and maybe a path to a new understanding of human life and medicine. This hour on Point, our microbiome and the full ecology of human life. You can join the conversation. Are we more than you thought? More microbial, more bacterial? Do we need a new mental picture of the ecosystem of our individual lives? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Jennifer Ackerman, author of this month's cover story in Scientific American. Her piece, The Ultimate Social Network, offers a surprising look at our bodies and the incredible microbial ecosystem they carry. Jennifer, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you, Tom. It's delightful to be here.
So give us the old picture and the new picture. We sort of thought of ourselves as islands or castles or something. What's the old? What's the new?
Yeah, so we did. We thought of ourselves as isolated from our environments. Actually, the first book I worked on the human body was a book called The Incredible Machine. We thought of ourselves as this, machine, basically, that functioned independently of
pristine, just leave it alone, it'll be great.
Pristine, exactly. And really what we're coming to understand is that we are indeed an ecosystem. We're a community of interacting cells. And as you said, only a tenth of which are our own. And, this really requires a complete shift in thinking, I think, in medical practice to a kind of medical ecology that managing our bodies is in large part going to be a question of managing our wildlife.
Our wildlife. Talk to us about what's in that wildlife, that microbiome. You're talking here about 10 times as many bacteria cells. I'm reading something here like, is it truly 100 trillion microbe cells? I know numbers get big when things get small, but what's in us? What's on us?
Okay, so yeah, it's 100 trillion microbes that call us their home. And the reason we don't look like big blobby masses of microbes is because their cells are much, much smaller than ours. Mm-hmm. So really only about a tenth to a hundredth the size of ours. And if you took all those bacterial cells and pulled them out of the body, they'd weigh about 2 to 5 pounds.
Let's just pause on that for a moment. That means each of us is carrying 2 to 5 pounds of microbes. That's not a teeny tiny portion of our weight.
No, it's not. It's pretty significant. And the really significant thing is the genes that these microbes contribute. So the human genome, we now understand, has about 20,000 or so genes. Mm-hmm. Well, these microbes that live within us contribute their genes to our microbiome, and there are probably 5 million to 8 million microbial genes in our bodies, doing lots of different things. There are well over 3 million genes in our digestive system alone from, more than 1,000 different species, and they are all doing various and sundry jobs.
So we are really walking ecosystems of a microbiome, of a microbial genetics here, in addition to, a kind of a core, if that's even the way to put it, of our own. We've been raised to think, my gosh, get away from the germs, but these are doing a lot of things for us, in us, on us. Like what, Jennifer?
Well, yeah. So until recently, we really thought that these bacteria, we knew they were present. We thought they were just kind of freeloaders. And now we are really beginning to understand that they play very essential roles in our bodies. The microbes in our gastrointestinal tract, for instance, they allow us to digest foods and absorb nutrients that our bodies really otherwise couldn't handle. We really don't have all of the enzymes that we need to digest our own food. Mm-hmm. So microbes provide those. They also make beneficial compounds like vitamins and anti-inflammatory substances that our own genome can't make.
So they're not just freeloaders. They're over time what they come to sort of work with the human cells all around them, work with our body processes.
That's exactly right. They've co-evolved with us. And so they really have a whole variety of jobs. Turns out they promote the differentiation of our tissues. They stimulate our immune systems. And they even may regulate our appetites and our normal brain function. This is some cutting-edge research, but it's very interesting.
So when we get rid of them, we may, or stay away from them, we make it in a zone of potentially encouraging obesity or autoimmune diseases. We'll look at that. Jennifer, when a human is still in the womb, it's bacteria-free, as I understand. So where does this load of microbiology come from? When does it join us?
Well, it starts at birth. Babies are born essentially sterile. They come out of the womb sterile. But a newborn is a little bit like a bacterial sponge, or it's been called a microbe magnet. So minutes after birth, the bacteria start to move in. And that colonization by these microbes has been likened to kind of, I guess you'd call it ecological succession. You begin with a few species and it gets richer and richer over time.
And it starts right in the birth canal, right as the baby's emerging from the mother. It's getting a whole lot right there at the sort of portal, at the exit. A whole lot of bacteria, microbes come on board that the baby needs.
That's right. And as the baby passes through the birth canal, it picks up bacteria from the mother's vaginal microbiome, and even her gut microbiome might contribute to the pool of bacteria that an infant acquires at birth. So the method of birth is actually very important in establishing the composition of your microbes. Vaginal delivery delivers a different kind of microbial composition than cesarean section.
If you come straight out of the womb, you're not going to make that journey through the birth canal. You're not going to where I think it was you who wrote, Jennifer. I mean, our bodies are very tuned into this. They're sort of loading that birth canal with specific sometimes bacteria, microbiology in the weeks before the birth.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me that the bacterial composition of the vagina actually changes during pregnancy. And there's a big shift of species, and one of the species that blossoms, really, mm-hmm. is a lactobacillus species that coats the baby, and they think helps the baby actually digest breast milk.
Which is pretty important in evolutionary terms, and right now for a newborn. How long do we keep taking on this essential microbiome? And what I found fascinating here was that, though we all have it, every human being depends on it, it's different in everybody, depending on, it's kind of like sourdough bread, depending where you pick up the starter stuff, you've got a different profile.
That's absolutely right. And you continue to acquire bacteria through at least the first couple of years of life, and it continues through diet, environment, various kinds of environmental exposure will affect your composition. And it's true that the really interesting findings of the Human Microbiome Project, which has just released its findings, suggest that each person's collection of bacteria truly is unique. It's like a fingerprint. And that, to me, is very interesting because it starts to unravel the mystery that was presented by the Human Genome Project.
Are some better than others when it comes to the microbiome you end up with? Do some promote better health than others? That profile,
well, we're just
that fingerprint?
We're beginning to tease apart those factors. We're trying to understand, first of all, what lives in the body, what job those microbes do, and how they differ from person to person, and their impact on health and disease. So we don't know yet whether there's a really terrific, healthy microbiome that's better than your neighbors.
Though, I mean, this is taking on some incredible facets already. I mean, you've got people having whose digestive tract, for example, may lose a good, healthy abundance of microbes, who are getting essentially poop transplants at this point. Sounds crazy, but it's really going on to sort of get the right microbial action in there.
Absolutely. I mean, I think people resist this idea because there's a big yuck factor, but
it's a big deal. It's happening, right? I mean, the things we learn are amazing, but there it is.
Right. I mean, one of the interesting stories here is that when the our microbiomes are disrupted in the gut because of maybe a heavy use of continuous use of antibiotics. Mm-hmm. There are species that will bloom. They're pathogens that just take over. One of them is Clostridium difficile, and it's causes terrible diarrhea. It's very difficult to get rid of. And so one of the treatments for this is a fecal transplant. It's basically
get a better restoring, culture going in there.
Right, restoring mm-hmm. the normal flora by bringing it in from the outside.
That's just incredible. And then, as you point out, there's all this thought about, I mean, if you have, let's say, a C-section birth and a lot of antibiotics and you start killing off a whole lot of, we've got some key microbes that what 80% of people used to have, 6% have now that may have to do with regulating appetite. This may point toward obesity.
Yes, that's right. This is very interesting work that has been done by Martin Blaser, who will be on your program in a little bit. But Helicobacter pylori, which was thought of as a pathogenic bacterium because it triggers the formation of gastrointestinal ulcers, turns out it's also implicated in regulating a hormone called ghrelin, which is the one in our bodies that stimulates appetite. So you take away the Helicobacter pylori, and you don't have that careful regulation of ghrelin.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the full ecology of the human body and the bacteria in us, on us, that outnumber our own cells 10 to 1. Looking at the growing understanding that really microbes are us. Jennifer Ackerman is with us. She's written the cover story on this month's Scientific American. It's called The Ultimate Social Network, and it's all that stuff going on in our bodies. You can find a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. It's really something to get your head around, this sort of different sense of how connected we are, how much we are hosts to life and not islands or just castles defending against. Here's a little bit that drives that home from the Radio Lab episode, Guts. This is from season 10 of the Public Radio Show. Host Robert Krulwich talked with science writer Carl Zimmer about the bacteria and microbes in your gut. Here's Krulwich first.
If you zoom into our intestines, what you'll see is legions of tiny creatures.
Bacteria, viruses, fungi, protozoans.
And those are all little single cell kind of guys?
Yeah, we're talking about non-human things inside of me.
How many have you got, would you say?
Me?
Yeah.
Probably in the order of maybe a couple thousand species. So there's E. coli, Bacteroides fragilis, and then another one.
It's a whole universe down there.
Yeah.
Microbacteria.
Gravobacterium.
Yersinia.
Diphalococcus.
Chromobacter.
Clostridium micophilus.
Some of them you'll find in all of us.
And then there are just a whole bunch of other species that are rarer, might be in one person and not in the other.
It's like a rainforest.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, like the rainforest, that is you, that is me, that is us. Jennifer Ackerman joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Medicine is looking at this. We're going to talk with a venture capital guy at a big biotech convention who's all over this these days. And Jennifer Ackerman is with us with all the background. Martin Blaser is with us right now as well from New York City. He is chair of the Department of Medicine and professor of microbiology and internal medicine at New York University School of Medicine. Sits on the scientific advisory boards for several companies focused on translating all this into products, but he's been looking at it for years, was president of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Martin Blaser, Dr. Blaser, thank you very much for being here.
Tom, thank you for having me.
So here, we've got people responding, and I just want to get your response. Here, Mark writes to us, Dr. Blaser says, this is going to freak out all those poor souls who fear microbes. The whole industry has grown out of the fear of germs. Then on Facebook, Derek writes to us, we are constellations, constantly in motion. We must abandon the compulsion to find pieces and start to heal systemically. These are listeners responding to what they're hearing. Have they got the right idea, Dr. Blaser?
Well, as was said, whole industries have been made about fighting germs and killing germs, and some of that is important because there are some very bad germs out of there. Mm-hmm. But looking at it another way, we've had germs living in us ever since we were animals. This goes back at least 500 million years. And ever since we were mammals, babies have been born through a birth canal, acquiring microbes from their mother as getting their start in life. So nature has built this coexistence between us and them. In fact, it's a little hard to say who are we. They're as much us as we are.
What are the most important functions from your medical research perspective that the microbiome performs with or for us?
Well, I think that there are so many that it really touches all aspects of human physiology and function. This includes metabolism, how we eat, how we process foods. It involves immunity, how we fight the bad guys, the pathogens, and as Jennifer said, how our immunity actually develops early in life. There's thought that it has to do with the development of intelligence and personality as well. Everything that develops in the body is probably a partnership between our genes and our microbial genes, and this has been choreographed over a long period of time.
Explain that last one, how your personality, mine, Jennifer's, or our intelligence might be shaped by that load of microbes, bacteria that we get at birth or in the months and years that follow. How would that work?
Well, of course, you've picked on the most speculative area, the area which we really have the least work on, but it is intriguing. You know, the brain develops in a milieu, and that milieu includes microbes and their products. And there's more and more evidence from animal studies that the nature of the microbes and the products that are getting into the bloodstream affect the kinds of connections that are made in the brain. This is a very intriguing area of work, and ultimately it could touch on important diseases involving human development, human cognitive development.
But, I mean, are we going to see a century from now people racing around the world to let their babies play in some special dust at the base of Mount Fuji or something because geniuses grow there or somewhere in the Black Forest?
It's a good idea, but I think not, because the microbes in the dust are probably irrelevant to us. Hmm. What is relevant to us are the microbes that we've had since time immemorial, microbes that I think some of which are disappearing. And Jennifer and you mentioned this organism in the stomach, Helicobacter pylori. Mm-hmm. There's evidence now that humans have had Helicobacter ever since we've been humans, at least 200,000 years.
And it goes to appetite?
And over the course of the 20th century, this organism is disappearing.
Why?
So a generation of children are growing up without this organism, and we know that it's involved in important aspects of physiology, including the hormones that control appetite and energy. It's involved in the T cells that are involved in immunity, and there's a linkage there with the rise of allergies and asthma. So I'm very concerned about the disappearance of our ancestral organisms.
I mean, why do you think that's happening? Are we hand sanitizing and C-sectioning and antibioticing ourselves into microbe-free zone where we really need them?
Yes, all of those. And I think it's cumulative. Because of our fear of germs and because of the powerful instruments that we have, we are causing collateral damage to our microbiome. No one imagined that when we did C-sections for important medical reasons that we would be depriving the children of their ancestral microbiome, but now the scale is very high. 30% of the kids born in the United States have had C-sections. Probably half the women in the United States who are pregnant are receiving antibiotics at some time during their pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And what doctors like myself didn't used to think is that this could affect the transmission of microbes from one generation to the other. Yep. But there's more and more evidence that it does.
And we're talking very large scale, 30% in the U.S., something like 2/3 in China. That's pretty incredible. In the U.S.,
So we're changing human ecology right under our nose without considering these consequences. Now, because of the emphasis on the microbiome, I think we're going to have a chance to really understand what we're doing and see if we can turn things around.
This is news for a lot of us. What's the line that might be drawn from that diminished microbiome to widespread American obesity?
Well, as you point out, there are a number of diseases that have been rising dramatically over the last few decades. Obesity, type 1 diabetes, type 2 diabetes, asthma, childhood allergies, food allergies. We have been working in this field for a number of years and are beginning to develop data in mouse models that early development is a really critical time. And if the microbiota are altered, then that's going to change early development. And we have studies in progress with mice in which early life antibiotics are increasing the amount of fat in these mice.
If you miss that early load of microbial material that would be healthy to get, can you somehow take it on later? Can I, drink a bottle of Activia and I'm all set?
Well, we don't know the answer to that question. We hope to find out, can we restore what is lost? Or it may be that it is what it is for the current generation, but the emphasis will be on future generations so that we prevent loss and we actually try to restore our ancient ecology.
Incredible. We've got lots of listeners with lots of questions here. If I may, Jennifer Ackerman, Martin Blaser, please stand by. Clark is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Clark, thanks. You're on the air.
Greetings.
Hi.
The subject that I'm wondering about was touched on a few minutes ago. I was wondering if any of the ongoing studies are looking at the spinal column and brain, if there's any colonization there, and if it might be possible that they are affecting our behavior.
That's great. Thank you very much, Clark. Martin Blaser, I mean, first of all, maybe just to clarify where we have all this microbiology and where we don't, inside and outside our body. And then what about spinal column, brain, behavior?
Yeah, so in general, we carry the microbes in the gastrointestinal tract from the mouth down to the rectum. It's on our skin and women in the vagina and all of our orifices. This is where the big populations are. Mm-hmm. And the microbes don't actually have to get to the brain. In fact, as far as we know, there are few, if any. But their products could get to the brain through the bloodstream. So materials that are made in the gut are routinely processed through the liver into the bloodstream, and they're circulating throughout the body. In fact, there was a study that compared mice that were normal and mice that have never seen microbes, and it was found that about two-thirds of the substances in the blood are of microbial origin.
Incredible. In the blood of microbial origin, but they're not microbes.
No, but they're the products of a microbe. Now, I like to use the analogy of battleships offshore shelling the coast of Normandy or shelling somewhere else. If you're getting the shell, it doesn't matter where the battleship is.
Wow. Maggie in Leominster, New Hampshire. Maggie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering, is there any thought of going into trying to genetically engineer the microbes that are in our bodies so that they can affect treatment of disease or anything else with the genetically engineering the microbes?
Maggie, let us pick it up. And Jennifer, I'll come first to you. Are you hearing about people who might be trying to engineer like the perfect package, the perfect microbiome to present it to, baby John or Juan or Lucy or even parts of it, Jennifer?
Well, I think what we're understanding, and Martin, you can correct me here, but that it's the microbes themselves that contribute the gene pool, and those are what we're we can use the whole microbe. That's what evolved with us, and it's less a matter of changing the microbes than it is figuring out a way to introduce populations of microbes that might be beneficial.
But Martin, you're saying that we may be losing some of our ancestral microbiome, this great body of microbes. I mean, can we hang on to it like some rainforest recipe and maybe one day recreate it, even optimize it via genetic engineering?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. I want to go one step beyond what Jennifer said, and that is we've been doing studies on Helicobacter pylori, the organism that has been lost, with the idea that one day doctors are going to be giving it back to children to help protect them against asthma and esophageal disease and maybe issues of metabolism. And through support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we have a project to engineer H. pylori so it can deliver some antigens to vaccinate children against cholera and Shigella. We want to hitchhike on the great ability of of Helicobacter to colonize the stomach so that we can deliver vaccines. Now, this is very forward-looking. It's going to take some years to accomplish, but we may be able to harness our microbes to do some work for us.
Maggie, thanks for your question. We're looking this hour at the full ecology of the human body, microbiome included. Let's go to Daniel in Newton, Massachusetts. Daniel, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. My name is Daniel Pastor. I'm a physician here in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Around 10 years ago, when I was a medical student down at Duke, I did some work in one of the immunology labs with Dr. Randy Bollinger and Dr. Bill Parker. At any rate, it showed a very interesting, in fact, unexpected finding where antibodies in the gut, the so-called secretory antibodies, which I'll also point out are in breast milk, actually had a probiotic effect. In fact, the antibodies, which we always associate with killing bacteria, actually cause certain beneficial bacteria to flourish.
What is this, like a forest fire that then leads to new growth? Or is that the right metaphor, Daniel?
I think it's more of like a fertilizer in that forest, and that these antibodies could have an absolutely paradoxical effect to the beneficial bacteria.
And you're talking about antibacterial material that would actually encourage bacterial growth ultimately. Did I get you right?
Exactly. Certain beneficial bacteria, these antibodies were promoting them to the detriment of the bad bacteria.
Interesting.
If I fast forward now 10 years, yeah. Where I now have a 3-year-old child and a 4-month-old child, and you look at how children are in effect sort of designed to work, they put things in their mouth.
Right.
And their bodies are digesting these things. And one of the things that I recall from my time in the lab is that the vast majority of immune cells, about 90% of them, are in the gut.
Mm-hmm.
The gut is designed as a massive processing center for these bacteria. And when I look at a lot of our friends who create these sort of antiseptic Purell bubbles for their children, it always makes me fear that they're doing potential damage to their kids.
I'm sure people are listening very closely to those observations, Daniel, and I appreciate your call. Marty Blazer, so first on the antibacterials, can you imagine them ultimately actually encouraging the growth of the microbiome? I mean, that's the first people's first thought, judging from a lot of response here, is should I throw out the hand sanitizer?
Well, there are a couple questions here, but I think that Daniel's point is very important because you have to realize we have grown up with bacteria, you know, for the last hundreds of millions of years. They are part of us in nature. In a classic example of Darwinian selection, selects for the good guys and tries to select against the bad guys. So it's not surprising that we have substances that favor the organisms we want to colonize us. And some of those substances also disfavor the bad guys. Jennifer pointed out about lactobacillus coming from the vagina of the mother into the baby's mouth that then inoculates the breast, and then the breast milk is full of lactose, which is food for lactobacilli, and lactobacilli form the foundation for the microbes that are eventually going to colonize the GI tract. So nature has kind of figured this out across generations. It's making substances that select for the good guys and inhibit the bad guys.
I mean, Jennifer, I'm sure people are thinking about child rearing here. Does it make you want to, I don't know if you have babies, but if you do or will, you know, sort of take them out and roll them in all kinds of stuff to get a good big rainforest of microbiome going, Jennifer?
Well, I've always believed that that kids should just be exposed to the environment in a healthy way. I mean, we have animals. I don't use antibacterial cleansing products. And I'm really careful about the use of antibiotics with my children.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the full ecology of the human body and the bacteria in and on us that outnumber our own cells 10-1, the growing understanding that microbes are us. Dr. Martin Blazer joins us from New York University's School of Medicine, big figure on this frontier of research with us today. Jennifer Ackerman is with us. She wrote The Ultimate Social Network. It's the cover story on Scientific American this month, and there's been a lot going on this front. We're going to hear in just a few minutes from a venture capitalist who is looking to push medicine in this direction. Martin Blazer, Jennifer, we've got lots of questions here online. I mean, here's Robin says, I'm currently on an antibiotic for bronchitis What can I do to help restore my good bacteria during and after treatment? Martin Blaser, what do you say?
Well, it's a very good and important question. I'm a specialist in infectious disease, and for generations now, we have been telling people, take all of your antibiotic and take it to the end of the course. And I'm not sure anymore whether that's the right idea. Part of the problem is that we actually never studied how long the courses should be. And my concern is that we're actually over-treating people a lot.
Well, how much of our microbiome dies when I start taking that antibiotic for, let's say, bronchitis?
We don't know the answer to that question. But my speculation is that every time we take an antibiotic, a couple of species go to extinction. So we used to think that we would suppress organisms, and then they'd go down, and then they'd come back up. But once they go to zero, they don't come back up anymore. And my concern is that we're getting a series of extinctions every time we take antibiotics. And then the next generation passes on a diminished microbiome to the next generation.
Gosh, that's pretty incredible here. Melrose writes to us on Twitter, says, I wonder if the reason I'm so healthy is because by first world standards, I'm not that fussy about super cleanliness. What do you say to that, doctor?
You know, again, I think that the microbes that our dogs have and farm animals and that are in soil and hay are not that relevant to humans. Now, this is different. A lot of people think that they're very important, but I think the organisms that are important are the ones that we've evolved with for millions of years, our human organisms.
It's the people, your mother, your siblings, and we don't have as many siblings anymore either.
That's right. We don't have – a lot of organisms are passed to us by our older siblings. Well, we don't have as many older siblings because family size has gotten smaller.
So – hang out with humans there, Melrose, and take on all you can. Randy's calling from North Ferrisburg, Vermont. Randy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Another great subject. I just wanted to relay an experience where I've been a participant in this bacteria transfer.
Oh, good. Like how?
Ackerman talked about. My first deployment to Afghanistan, I was very ill for about a month, and I later understood that it wasn't really the exotic nature of the new foods I was trying over there, but probably that I was having a wholesale transfer of Eastern Hemisphere bacteria inside me, displacing the stuff that I went over there with.
Mm-hmm.
And on my subsequent tour, I didn't have any problems. I don't know, even with a span of 4 years between tours, if I had enough remnant Eastern Europe or Eastern Hemisphere bacteria that somehow inoculated me. But
It's a great question, Randy. I'm so glad you raise it. Martin Blaser, how about it? It's a little microbial geography there. Does it matter where you go? Could you take on, you know? I mean, I spent years in Asia. Does that mean I've got an Asian sector in my microbiome?
Well, here's where it gets complicated, because we've been focusing on the good guys, but there are bad guys out there. And in many parts of the world, like Afghanistan, sewage isn't very good. And sewage and water and food get contaminated. And so people are exposed to pathogens, like certain pathogenic strains of E. coli. And so when people go to developing countries like that, they get traveler's diarrhea or turista. It's not because of the wholesale bacteria, but very specific pathogens. The good news is once you've gotten it, then you're immune to it. So it could be that this gentleman's improvement is that he had it, and now he's immune to it. But one of the things that protects us against the bad guys are our good guys, the normal organisms. And it's been known for more than 50 years that antibiotics suppress the good guys, increasing people's susceptibility to the bad guys if they get exposed. So people who get exposed to salmonella, if they've had antibiotics in the last month or two, they're at higher risk.
Boy, so many pieces to this. Rick in Worcester, Massachusetts. Rick, you're on the air.
Hello. I actually have been an anti-infective drug discovery researcher for about 20 years. And one of the things that I read about 5 or 10 years ago was Michael Pollan's story of The Botany of Desire.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a question, and I hope I can distinguish it from some of the things you've been talking about. And that is, now that we have the microbiomes and we have the human genome, is it possible to identify genetic bases or behaviors in humans that actually lead us to go out and seek to become infected by beneficial bacteria in much the same, and that the bacteria have evolved ways of living and colonizing that actually attract us. And so we've got this kind of convergent evolution here.
That is interesting. Martin Blaser, are we evolved to go out and mix it up with the microbiology that we need?
Could be. I wouldn't be surprised. I can't think of any examples in humans that I know of yet, but we know that in worms, there are bacteria that control how the worms have sex and when the worms have sex so that they can improve transmission of the worms' bacteria around the world. So the bacteria are actually controlling their reproduction.
Well, I mean, I don't know what it would be. We do a lot of kissing as humans. Mouths are full of microbiology. I mean, could that be an evolutionary transfer system?
You know, there aren't that many things that are accidental. And if kissing feels good, there's probably a reason.
Let's look at the business side of this and where medicine may go for just a minute here. Bernard Oyer joins us. He's in Boston, in our backyard, at the Bio International Convention that's going on here right now. Big global convention of folks in biotech. He's a principal at Pure Tech Ventures, focused on the creation of life sciences companies. One of them they founded is called Vedanta Biosciences. Their lead program focuses on using the microbiome to protect against autoimmune diseases, particularly inflammatory bowel diseases like colitis and Crohn's. Bernard Oyer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
So do we need a revolution in our pharmacology to bring in this line of thinking? Are we going to see a different kind of medicine in this century based on the understanding of the microbiome?
We think we will. We think that that we have to honor the good work that guys like Marty are doing in the field, really helping understand the science by doing proper translation into therapies. And we think that there's a huge opportunity to really mind this space in a way that really hasn't been done today.
In simple terms, how would therapies based on understanding of microbiome be different from our current era of therapies?
Well, the therapies that we take today, like antibiotics, that do affect the microbiome, do that accidentally. That was not the plan. And what the opportunity here is really to design a whole new class of therapies that would modulate the microbiome in a way where we can bring about benefit outcomes.
Modulate the microbiome, like what might that mean?
That might mean changing the compositions of the microbes that we have in the gut in a way that resemble more the microbiome of a healthy person. So we are starting to see in a number of diseases, like inflammatory bowel diseases, infections, etc., if you look at the microbiomes of patients with the disease, they look severely altered. And we would want to make them look more like the healthy microbiomes of people that don't have the disease, for example.
What about the stuff that's on supermarket shelves now? There's a lot of talk about probiotics, you know, little yogurty drinks. Are those for real? Is that serious? Or is that just nibbling around the edges? How do you look at those?
With some skepticism, which is probably the same thing that Marty would tell you. There's a mixed record of those having shown efficacy. But I think that those don't really capture the picture of what can be done from a pharmaceutical standpoint in the field. The problem with many of the organisms that are sold on the shelf is that they cannot even colonize us. So you take them, they go in, they go out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to expect a meaningful effect if the organism doesn't even stay in you to live. The real opportunity here is to focus on the other organisms that highly colonize us, that have evolved to play very important roles in our health, and do drug development around those organisms.
Is there a different conceptual framework required by our pharmaceutical industry? And are pharmaceuticals even the right home for this era of medicine? Or is it more, you know, homeopathic and organic?
Yeah. We think there's opportunities for foods, for supplements, but also for medicine. And because the effects that we're discovering around the microbiome are so profound, they really open the door to real therapies that can cure patients with important diseases, that can revert those diseases or protect them, because the effects are really meaningful. Pharma companies will eventually embrace this field because it's very important for medicine. The key question is when. And from our point of view, you know, the right time is now. And I think that you can start to see these days, for example, at Bio, that there's a lot of interest in the farmers and entry. Whether they will be they have the right tools, that's not necessarily the case today, because their expertise is more around making synthetic molecules and doing good chemistry around them,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to giving live organisms. But eventually, they'll figure out how to make live organisms.
Big new world coming up. Bernard Ouye is at the enormous Bio, International Biotech Convention in Boston right now. He's a principal at Pure Tech Ventures. Bernard, thank you very much for your observations today.
Thanks, Tom.
Let's go to Cynthia in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Cynthia, thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm calling to ask a question about the birth process. My daughter was born in her birth sac. It didn't break until after she came out of the birth canal. So
amazing.
Is she going to have any of these benefits?
Oh, Marty Blaser, what do you say? That's an incredible story.
Well, you know, the first thing to say is that people have been born by cesarean section for a long time. And there don't seem to be any profound problems with people who've been born by C-section. My concern is that there are subtle problems and there things may be cumulative, but that remains to be seen. So far, no one yet has shown much of a subtle problem, although there was just a paper from Boston, actually, that showed that children born by C-section were more likely to develop obesity, which is consistent with the idea of the transfer of an altered microbiome. In the case of your daughter in the breast sac, it's hard for me to know. One of the important things, of course, is that when babies are born, they go up against the mother's skin and the mother's breast. Mothers often kiss and lick mm-hmm. their babies. Mm-hmm. All of this actually transfers mother's microbes to the baby, which is probably how nature intended it.
Cynthia, how was your child born by C-section or just came through the birth canal with the birth sac intact?
She was born in her regular vaginal birth,
yeah.
But the birth sac didn't break until she came out.
Right. Well, Martin, just to go a little further with that, I mean, I know what you mean, having raised a lot of livestock, seen ewes and their lambs, and, you know, they're licking and licking and licking. In Cynthia's case, or if that should happen, is, you know, what do you do? Just take, once the baby's out of the birth sac, like, just give it a lot of physical time. It's never going to have a second ride through the birth canal.
It's hard to, we're just at the early points in studying this, and it's hard to generalize about individual cases.
Mm-hmm.
But we're interested in studying all the ways that nature has designed that transfer across generations, especially from the mom to the baby. And again, siblings and dad probably have some role as well, but that relationship with mom is very important. A very wonderful study was done by Maria Gloria Dominguez Bello and Rob Knight, looking at the difference of the microbiota in babies born by cesarean section and vaginal delivery. And if you looked at the bacteria shortly after birth in the babies, you could match them up to their mothers.
Wow.
But in the cesarean section, you couldn't. And that's very interesting to us, this kind of matchup, because it may have something to do with the bonding that occurs between mothers and babies. A lot of bonding has to do with odor,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of odor has to do with microbes.
This is amazing stuff. One more call. Pittsburgh, Sophie's calling. Hi, Sophie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just had a quick question, which mm-hmm. is that something that's very popular in the health food movements is things like colon cleanses and
yeah.
those types of things. And I'm wondering, based on what you guys are saying about wanting to preserve the microbiology systems that we have, if something like that might actually have a detrimental effect to creating those good cultures.
That's a great question, Sophie. Thank you for calling. Jennifer, you see people running away from colon cleanses because they want to hang on to their microbiome or not?
Well, I think Marty should probably answer this question, but it's certainly something I would stay away from.
Martin Blaser, what do you say? It has had a big run of popularity in recent years.
You know, there are a lot of fads in medicine and homeopathy. A lot of things are popular 1 year, and 10 years from now, we wonder, why did we do this? And I think a lot of these colon cleansings, they've never really been rigorously tested. Do they have any beneficial effect? There are a lot of conceptions and misconceptions. It's not something I would do.
So here we are with this understanding, kind of getting out with help of people like Jennifer and, of course, your work, Martin Blaser, into popular understanding. Do you think we, I mean, it sort of changes our sense of what we are. We're not these islands. We're not these pure, noble machines, you know, trying to stay away from the world. We need the world. We're part of it. Will it change medicine in this century?
I think we are these pure, noble machines, but the bugs are part of our machinery, and it will change medicine. I think this is an extremely important frontier for medical discovery because our microbes are great physiologists. They're great cell biologists. The next generation of medicines is going to come from microbial products.
And watch out that we don't lose too much of our microbiome while we're waiting on that generation.
We're going to have to restore what's been lost.
Incredible. Martin Blaser is chair of the Department of Medicine and professor of microbiology and internal medicine at New York University School of Medicine, founder of the Foundation for Bacteriology and the Virtual Museum of Bacteria. Dr. Blaser, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Jennifer Ackerman in Charlottesville, Virginia, wrote the big Ultimate Social Network cover story in Scientific American. You can link to it at our website. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk.
Listeners, thanks for being here. This is On Point.